Hello, welcome, Current Affairs Bird Feed, to another super special bonus episode of the Current Affairs Podcast. This is Finance Editor Sparky Abraham. I'm always extra excited, but I'm extra, extra excited about this one. I feel like we're back into the infrastructure series, back into the disastrous infrastructure series. Anyway, I'm here with Megan Milliken Bibbin. Hi, Megan. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Sparky.
Oh, you're welcome. This is late. I like the mouthing what's up before saying very officially thank you. Megan.
You agreed to Zoom.
I did. So I even suggested it. So Megan is a former federal regulator, and you are also the founder of True Transition. And I expect that what True Transition is going to be related to what we're going to talk about today. But do you want to just tell people what True Transition is?
Well, we are in the nascent phases of planning what this organization will be, but I envision it being the space where we can elevate the voices of frontline oil and gas workers, the people who are being displaced currently, or the people who are being exploited in the fields, and to have their voice added to the conversation for our energy transition, but also to engage those people directly with the communities that are affected. Because oftentimes, those are the very same people living in those communities affected by this infrastructure. So it's going to be a bunch of things, but that is, I think, the heart of what I envision this organization to be.
Okay, perfect. When you say affected by this infrastructure, I think that's just going to get us right into what we're talking about, which is you very recently had an article published in Current Affairs called "The Wreckage of the Last Energy Epoch, Abandoned Wells and Workers." This article terrified me. Like, I really, really loved working on it and reading it. And it's also horrifying and hopeful. But it's one of these things that I knew basically nothing about. And you convinced me very, very quickly that it's extremely important and that we all need to be paying attention to it. So can you maybe just start by like laying out what the problem is here? Like, what were you writing about that we all need to worry about right now?
Okay. So I thought you did such a good job. I want to let the audience know to the degree that Current Affairs editors really kind of shepherd these pieces, because Sparky was like, well, I don't understand this. Because I come after things very much of, well, everyone should know these things, but Sparky's like, I don't know these things. So he helps fill in a lot of the gaps. So the basic spot you want to begin is, okay, you drill a hole in the earth and what is under the earth will come out.
Why do you drill the hole in the earth?
To access hydrocarbons, to access fossil fuel and natural gas. There is this idea that once you have, you know, exploited that field for the resource, that it's plug and done, that we plug cement into that well and we can walk away and it will never bother us again.
Okay, hold on. Let's take it back a little bit even more. Okay, so what you're saying, so we're starting at the point of extracting oil and gas from the ground, right? This is like your starting point, which is, you know, oil and gas being like the stuff that gets refined to be used as gasoline in cars. Also the natural gas that like runs the Glendale power plant, which is just a couple blocks from my house. There's a big giant pipe that runs over the river that says natural gas that goes straight to the power plant, right? Like all of this stuff starts in the ground. And so you're talking right now about starting with the process of getting it out of the ground and then what happens after we've gotten the oil and gas out of the ground in a particular place.
Yes. Sorry, guys. Yes, that's exactly right. See, the editor in action. Thank you. Exactly. And so for the audience, for an important thing to understand and recognize is that, you know, when Sparky said I was a federal regulator, yes, I worked for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and they manage the resources on the Outer Continental Shelf. And for, you know, the sake of, you know, the United States, that's mainly Southern California, a few leases, Alaska, and then the Gulf of Mexico. And I worked in the Gulf of Mexico's office. So I first came to this issue with orphaned wells, and those are wells where a company goes bankrupt and no one can plug the well. And so that's when I first came to it. I was like, okay, well, who's going to pay for this? But I realized once I started scratching that it is much more than just, okay, no one's going to pay for it. There's a whole bunch of wells across the United States that even if they were plugged, could build up with gas and one day leak again or explode. And so that's how I came to... Sorry, I'm like, there's so much to synthesize into one thing that I did a really good job in the article.
You did a great job in the article.
Well, I know. So hold on.
So just on like a very basic level, right? I'm an oil company or an energy company, and I want to go access some oil or gas that's in the ground, right? So I go and I scope it out and I find what I think is a deposit of oil or gas underground, whether that's on land or under the ocean, right? And so I'm going to dig a well down to it. And like, this is what you see. And like, there will be blood or whatever, right? Like they drill down and like the oil like shoots up maybe if it's under pressure underground. And then they pump out the oil over time, or they pump out the gas over time, right? And then they finish pumping it, and there's not really any left, or there's not a ton left, right? And so, like, what is the problem? Like, you're talking about, oh, you know, there's nobody there to plug the well. Why would you need to plug the well? What's happening?
So it's basically cleaning up after you're done. After you've made all your money, you need to come back, and you need to make sure that there's no risk of that oil seeping into a local water aquifer, or natural gas seeping into that water aquifer, or, you know, seeping out into the atmosphere, poisoning a local community. You know, increasingly for fracked wells, you have a risk of what are called natural occurring radioactive materials. So these are radioactive materials. It's really just making sure that the site is safe and does not pose a hazard or risk to nearby resources and people. And when you consider the history of the United States oil and gas industry, you're talking 10 million wells onshore and, you know, however many thousands of wells offshore. And, you know, the thing that was, you know, kind of I have learned over the last year or so is that even if a company does everything correctly, you know, they plug the well with cement and clay, you know, they check for leaks. This is an engineered product, and engineered products have engineered lives. And, you know, gas can build up, pressure can build up, a leak can form. And so it became very clear to me that, you know, this is something that requires monitoring in perpetuity. And, you know, we talked about, you know, oil and gas companies coming to find the resource. Well, there's a whole alphabet soup of state and federal agencies and private companies that oversee oil and gas leasing in the United States. You know, I worked for BOEM, but there's also the Bureau of Land Management. There's state programs, and they all oversee these leasing programs. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has two lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico every year, in the fall and the spring. Bureau of Land Management has something like monthly lease sales in different states. And so all these things add up, and they have different classification systems. They have different monitoring requirements. And so you just have this whole inventory of wells of various status, and they're posing threats to communities from coast to coast. And there's really just no uniform method or effort to grapple with that.
So when you say they're posing threats to communities, right, I guess like the bottom line is that hydrocarbons like natural gas and oil are just toxic as fuck, right? And so not a good thing to breathe, not a good thing to be by, not a good thing to drink. Can you like give some examples of, you know, when you say it's posing threats, like what kind of threats is it posing? Is this the kind of thing that actually manifests and hurts people?
Sure. And that's how I began this article, is, you know, highlighting some pretty egregious examples. For instance, in Firestone, Colorado, you know, there was a community that was built atop an old field, an old oil field. So below houses were, you know, just, you know, ginormous basins of former hydrocarbons that were building up with gas. And so one day that gas built up, and there was an explosion near a house where, you know, two men in the basement immediately died. The house collapsed onto a mother. A child had to jump out of a window. And, you know, if you talk to people familiar with this case, there was a big cover up on how, even after the fact, you know, when the fire department responded, there was gas still posing a threat to the community. And then, of course, in Los Angeles, I showed an example of a well from what, the 1930s, that they were trying to reseal as they were building a parking lot around it. And they had two crews. They had an oil and gas crew. They had a construction crew who were dealing with the parking lot. And, you know, there was a blowout, and, you know, showered the construction worker with gas and oil. And meanwhile, it's emitting methane and other chemicals as people are just going about their day in Los Angeles. And, you know, like another one I featured in Ohio, where there was an orphan well underneath the school with a leak. And like these kind of things happen over and over and over again. And they're always treated by the local news as like this discrete, weird freak accident. Like, oh, what a weird thing. But there, if you add them all up, it's quite a lot. And, you know, because you have so many different agencies and so many different organizations kind of overseeing this, you know, and especially with fracking and how close it's happening to existing communities, we're at the risk of losing so many wells. Like, where are they? That we are very likely going to build new communities or new things that, you know, will conflict with there being like explosive gas underneath. And so these risks are just, you know, accumulating over time. And, you know, and the thing that we haven't talked about is methane, you know, this gas that I don't know the number exactly, however many times more potent than carbon dioxide, is just spewing out of these wells. And so if we want some low hanging fruit in terms of, you know, lowering our emissions, you know, these wells are probably one of the number one spots we can start.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just make sure I got this right. Okay. So what you're saying is that there are literally millions of holes in the ground out around the United States on land, and then also a bunch offshore, that these holes, maybe not all of them, but many of them probably are like leaking toxic material and leaking methane, which is a significant greenhouse gas and contributing to climate change. And also just kind of like posing a threat for people. And that it sounds like what you're saying is that the regulation, and I know I'm just kind of like playing dumb here because I read it in the article, but what you're saying is that the regulation of this stuff is really kind of like piecemeal, right? So you've got like different states trying to do things, different states do it different ways. I expect probably the actual resources themselves don't necessarily obey state boundaries. What'd you say? Did you say 10 million wells? Is there like, do we even know how many there are or where they all are?
So that is a number I got from Department of Energy, Office of Fossil, I can't remember the exact acronym. And it was a number they said, like, you know, over 150 years of oil and gas exploration, there's been 10 million wells drilled. And so the number that you often get is from EPA, and they combine two different studies and they look at like how many abandoned wells exist. And so this is where we talk about in the article that the terminology is very confusing. So to abandon a well is to properly seal it. And so that when they say abandoned wells, they are saying, oh, these are sealed wells. But like in this article, in this context, they're also referring to orphan wells. Mm-hmm. And so the number that's been bantered about is 2.3 to 3 million wells, I believe.
Okay, so wait, an abandoned well is a sealed well. An orphaned well is an unsealed well, kind of.
See, this is where we have the wiggle. Yeah. So in the context of the EPA study, they're saying that even these abandoned wells are sources of greenhouse gas, right? Yeah, so but they're saying like that these are, you know, there's a leak somewhere. They're mm-hmm. leaking that needs to be detected and repaired. And orphaned is, you know, it refers specifically to a financial obligation. That means the company that, you know, owns that oil well has gone bankrupt or no longer exists, and you cannot pursue them to pay for the plugging and the abandonment. And so when you hear orphaned, it's typically like a legal term about like there is no financial solvent person or company to pursue.
Well, so I mean, this is kind of a question that I had from the article too, which maybe is just something that I missed, but like, so you're saying orphaned is kind of like a legal term about whether you can find someone who's still responsible for the well. Are companies that have sealed wells, which means that the wells could be abandoned technically, is the company still responsible for any leak that pops in the seal? Or can it be one and done, even though we recognize that sealing a well has a shelf life?
So this is an interesting conversation, and one that I have not completely, it's still out to lunch. And it's funny because I just spoke to someone from BESI, the sister agency of BOEM, yesterday, who maintains that they can pursue because they're like, it's still emitting, we can still pursue. And it's strange because like, I always think like, oh, there are so many things that need to be improved at BOEM and BESI, but compared to on lands, the regulations are actually much more robust. So in that context, you know, BESI, under some of the current leadership, they can pursue.
What are BOEM and BESI? These are offshore.
Offshore. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and the Bureau of Safety and Enforcement. Safety and Environment. Sorry. There's just so many. You should know BESI. We were BOEM Re for a while. And we were BOEM, BESI. There's a lot of acronyms. We've changed like three times. So to that question, BESI maintains that they can still pursue operators to plug existing leak. Onshore, it's more or less plug and done from my understanding of state programs and being able to pursue prior operators. And from what I understand for BLM, their enforcement, the Bureau of Land Management, which is still under the Department of the Interior, they just don't have the capacity to even pursue or even detect and monitor for leaks. Like that's not typically happening. And in the cases in the Gulf of Mexico, where there were leaks detected, there was like egregious leaks where there was a fisherman and they could see methane bubbles at the top of the water. You know, it's not like this is something that is happening, like is being monitored on a day-to-day basis. These are just very like discrete times where they're like, okay, this thing is leaking and it's not abandoned. You have to go back.
Do wells ever become safe? Like, is there a point? What you're saying is that, like, the thing that you do to make them safe is you plug them, or safer as you plug them, but that is temporary and that the stuff breaks down over time. Are we just creating forever problems every time we drill a well?
Yes, we are. And that is the uncomfortable truth that I think both industry has tried to sweep under the rug or, you know, distract people from recognizing, is that, again, engineered products have engineered lives. And it might only be a percentage of the wells that leak within the next 100 years, but that's still a significant percentage. And there's been some really good work, I think it was Mary King, showing that even wells that have been plugged and abandoned as recently as 10 years ago have been shown to leak. And so, yes, these are forever problems. And oil and gas is much more akin to something like nuclear energy, where the waste and the problems are forever. And so we have to confront that, like, this is something that must be monitored in perpetuity.
Yeah. I mean, just in talking about this, you're reminding me of some folks might remember Ashley McRae had an article in Current Affairs a little while ago about, like, the, I take every opportunity possible to plug it because it's one of my favorites, about the process of trying to deal with nuclear waste and the fact that it's going to be around and toxic for tens of thousands of years. And of course, it's very difficult to think on that time frame. And I think people think of that as a problem unique to nuclear waste. But, you know, even on a relatively smaller time frame, like, you think about if we've been drilling wells for 150 years and we're relying to a large extent on the companies that drill the wells to be responsible for them. You know, what companies drilled wells 150 years ago that are still around?
And those are, and these legacy wells too, you know, they were plugged with, you know, like wood or something, and they've been lost to our records. And so that's too, like, a challenge in of itself, is locating these old wells to know, like, okay, I mean, they might, like, you know, like a little bunny could fall on these things. And there have been cases where, like, woodland creatures and all kinds of things just pile up and people, you know, will use them for, like, throwing trash. So there is, like, a real strong reason to try to identify these as well.
So you start your article with kind of this, the stuff that you talked about a second ago, which is sort of like these horror stories that are written off as kind of one-off events in their local regions. But of course, if you add them up, you can see this, like, giant gnarly toll from the industry. But you also talked about methane and its contribution to climate change. And I think some of the numbers in your article were, like, really staggering in terms of how much methane orphaned and or abandoned wells may be responsible for putting into the atmosphere. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I'm going to have to pull up my exact numbers and get my Dr. Amy Townsend Small is a researcher in Ohio, and she is brilliant and awesome. And she's just wonderful. And she's done a lot of research on this. Yeah. So let's see, get some good methane statistics for y'all.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we're going to talk about, like, stripper wells, which are wells that are beyond their economic life, but they're just keeping them running. The companies are keeping these, like, you know, that's the sound of the pump jack.
If you drive around Southern California, which is where I live, right, you see these things all over the place, which is just, like, kind of a single, like, an empty lot with a single pump jack on it just going.
Yeah. And some of these wells, they're just, like, producing, I don't know, like a teaspoon of oil a week. You know, they're just, like, they're stripper wells. And the only reason why they're keeping them going is to forestall the cost of plug and abandonment. They don't want to do that. It's cheaper for them to have some guy come out, like, every other week and just check on it, or once a month. And, you know, Amy's research has shown that some stripper wells are venting or leaking 100% of the gas they produce. So those things are, if you put, like, you know, one of those little cool cameras on them, and you can just see, you know, methane spilling right above them. So every time you look past one of those pump jacks, just envision wiggly air, because that's what's happening above them.
Is there anybody responsible for monitoring that piece of it? Like, if you've got a stripper well, which is basically just out there existing for the sake of existing, because the company doesn't want to spend money to plug it. Like, that's crazy if they're leaking that much methane for zero economic benefit, basically just a cost avoidance. Who's responsible for looking at that?
Well, and that's, you know, gets to the heart of my work too. It should be the local, you know, in the case of California, if it's through the state, California has a leasing program. It has a state regulator. It has its, I don't know what the air quality name of the industry is. Sorry, the regulator is there. I always go DEQ because of Louisiana. They would be the ones in charge of regulating and monitoring it. But, you know, as we know, most of these agencies are skeleton operations. There's not enough people to actually go out and inspect and have the equipment and tools to keep track of it. And, you know, the existing regulations as they are, they do not pursue bad actors. The moral hazard is built as it is now. I mean, it's you know, when the industry writes the regulations and writes the laws, these are the outcomes we get. You know, this wasn't like, this was like, you know, an unintended consequence of good actors. You know, this is a system that is designed to function for these actors. I think that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I think, like, I was really compelled by in your article when you're kind of going through exactly how disjointed and sort of local and state-based a lot of these regulations are. Because, you know, I have some familiarity with, like, the Public Utilities Commission in California, and I know how effectively industry lobbies those those organizations and those regulators. And, you know, like, the regulators, I'm not saying they're doing a bad job necessarily, but, like, industry can put a lot of pressure on state agencies in a way that really is not being countered necessarily by environmentalist groups or community activists or anybody else. It's very, very difficult without a whole lot of resources. And again, I'm just looking back at your numbers here. And like one of the things you say is that the EPA estimate is that the documented abandoned oil and gas wells emit like 7.2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents. And that's basically equivalent of the equivalent to 1.5 million cars on the road just coming from the wells that the EPA knows about that were abandoned, right? Which is just nuts. It's between 5 and 11% of the methane emissions from the oil and gas production sector are coming from like idle or marginal wells, meaning things we're not getting any actual energy value out of. They're just their like existing legacy and slowly killing us.
And, you know, back to the state thing, it's like, you know, you look at California, you know, who is one of the biggest companies and, you know, tax evaders in California, you know, Chevron. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not just like the pressure on regulators, it's the purchase of state legislatures. And they're the ones that write your local zoning, they're everything, you know, your tax incentives, you know, being able to write off the infrastructure and the diminishing reserves. I mean, it's insane. Like everything is rigged towards this industry. Like it's some kind of infant Hamiltonian like business when it's existed for over a century.
They're a startup though. They're a startup, right? They got hired to help the startup.
They're a startup.
The other piece of this that you talk about that I think I was really glad that you kind of link these things together, right? As you go through a lot of the stats on the problem and the horror stories and the environmental effects, but then you also talk about the workers and the way that the industry has been kind of evolving in order to, you know, not only disclaim responsibility to all of us more broadly, but also discount responsibility to its own workers. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like what's been happening here?
All right, here we go. An interesting frame to understand oil and gas is one to intentionally diminish and displace the power of organized labor and specifically coal miners. The switch from coal to fossil, like to natural gas and oil. And I mean, it's like, I always reference Deepwater Horizon. You know, you think of BP spill and you think of all of the companies. Remember like, oh, it's Halliburton, it's Transocean, it's this. And when you think about these giant operations and you think of these huge transnational companies, you would think that they would be vertically integrated, you know, that they can do everything. They can do the, you know, the cementing, they can do everything. But they're very dispersed. There's just like, there's like 10 companies out there. And part of it is because of liability hot potato. You know, we could shift the blame. But also part of that is to ensure that no more than a few guys on that rig work for the same company. And so then you never have a culture of solidarity where guys can talk to each other about the unsafe working conditions, where they can elevate, you know, like, okay, how much are you getting paid? What's your day rate? Okay, they're moving us from 2 weeks on to 3 weeks on. And, you know, they're making us leave from this port instead of this port. I mean, all of these things conspire to diminish that power and to really isolate and dominate these workers. And that is something that really has, you know, over the last few years, you know, working with BOEM and, you know, full disclosure, and we've talked about this before, but my husband, he wasn't in the industry like directly, but he worked in the maritime sector, you know, doing the installation of these, of the rigs. And he was more on the engineering side, but just like looking at fabrication yards and shipyards associated with his work and just seeing to the degree that they have become like these contract workers, basically serfs, you know, like, oh, you're going to earn more if you just work as a contractor. Meanwhile, you don't have health insurance. You're working well beyond 40 hours. And when it comes down to like hourly pay, you're making what, $10? You know, everyone's 1099 now. And it's just a real, real shitty industry to work for. And like you always hear, and like right now, the rhetoric is thick after the recent executive order. So people are like, oh, you're taking away their jobs. And, you know, these are good oil and gas jobs. Solar panel, like panelists don't make shit. But you know, talk to someone who works in the industry right now, talk to someone who typically, you know, worked, you know, out in the field, and, you know, have they been fired more than, you know, a few times in the last few years? Probably. Have they had to move their family to go to another, you know, space to work? And that's a yes. Sorry, I'm going off on a rant, but like, this is really,
this is good. Bring the rant.
Yeah, bring the rant. It just, it really infuriates me because like, it's just a group of workers that is just experiences the most atrocious conditions. And, you know, Justin Noble has done some amazing work on, you know, radioactive exposure and fracking. And, you know, one of the things there's a few trends to really see in oil and gas. So contracting, we touched already. But there's also like, you know, okay, we're not going to classify you as an oil and gas worker. We're going to classify you as a truck driver, but you're going to be working with, you know, produced water, the stuff that comes up that is radioactive. And you're not going to be trained. You're not going to be, you know, equipped with the appropriate, you know, gloves and everything. And I mean, it's insane to the degree that this class of workers is just treated like trash. And yeah. And I feel like that is an opportunity where all of us could, you know, organize and say, hey, like, we want to give you safe working conditions and we still need your skills. And that's a good segue. And I can go on and on about labor, like, well, prison labor, visa labor, all of it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting to me, although, is like, it's funny how easy we've kind of made this for these companies, because you can use the exact same tactics to avoid responsibility and liability for the wells and infrastructure themselves and itself, and also for kind of the labor violations, right? Like, a lot of it is kind of just using the same structures, which is breaking down into a bunch of subsidiaries, using a bunch of subcontractors, kind of passing off the quote-unquote resources, whether those are wells or workers, to whoever, you know, to whichever organization can like structure itself most efficiently to avoid any responsibility for them. So you talk about, you know, these kind of like bottom feeder LLCs that get spun off in order to buy and own the abandoned and idle wells, so that, you know, if there is a problem, there's no money that is actually existing in order to fix it. And it's kind of a similar thing, I expect, for the workers too, who are being subcontracted by, you know, 10, 12, 15 different companies to all go work on essentially the same project in the same place. It's both an anti-organizing strategy and a liability avoidance strategy that looks kind of structurally similar to the same thing for the wells themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I wish I had it queued up, but there was a recent case where there was a discharge of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, it was a worker out on the rig that's facing criminal charges and prison time. And I see the trend towards that, where it's not the companies bearing the responsibility or liability. It's going to be the individual workers.
Oh, sure.
And so
yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, what is the exact benefit of this industry? You know, the pay has gone down. The hours are terrible. The safety is declining. The conditions are just, as I keep saying, atrocious, but they're just really bad. And now, like, you can face criminal charges as they threaten you out there. And that's the thing, like, I'm hearing from people is that, you know, they're being pushed into more unsafe scenarios and situations where it's like, you know, there's 10 guys who'll take your job. So if you don't do this thing, you know, congratulations, you know, someone else will. You know, what are you supposed to do in that kind of environment?
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned solar technicians as the sort of alternative, which I have my own rant about, but we won't do that today. Maybe we'll do that another day. Okay. So hold on a second here, Megan. What you're telling me is that we've got a national scale problem, environmental problem. We've also got sort of a national scale worker problem. We've got a huge amount of work that needs to be done in order to find and plug wells. And then we've got this army of people who have been exploited and cheated out of their jobs and laid off and whatever else. You know, is there any way to address these two problems at the same time?
Wow, Sparky, I'm so glad you asked that. And one thing that we didn't say and didn't speak is not only are people treated terribly, but there's just no jobs. I mean, right. That is something that, you know, like the Gulf of Mexico has actually been experiencing record production. It's like the highest amount of production in its entire however many decades life. And part of that is just they're going into deeper waters and they're hitting deeper fields. But in that same time, I'm going to have my statistics in front of me. So for Louisiana specifically, between 2008 and 2019, direct employment for oil and gas extraction fell by 26.9%. Drilling oil and gas well jobs plummeted by 62.4% in that time period. Okay, that's Trump's time. That's how many jobs I mean, this is before the EO. This is before, you know, the price war, the Saudi-Russian price war. 62.4% jobs vanished. And then, of course, support activities for oil and gas operation decreased by 26%. So there we go. So shitty conditions. There's no jobs. And they're not going to be rehiring people because why would they? They're decreasing their marginal cost. And we have all these wells. And so that's where this wonderful idea comes in, the abandoned well administration. And so that's my big shtick, folks. And that's what I'm going to be selling you today, is that we can have big government again that actually serves people and employs people. And we should, because we need it. We need to. These people are out of work and they have skills. And before those skills vanish into obscurity, into, you know, a lower paying job that doesn't utilize them, or before they succumb to, you know, a disease of despair, we could be using those skills to make our communities literally safer and healthier. And so that is, yeah, we can go into more specific questions before I go into rants, but that is the idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, so just in broad strokes, what is the abandoned well administration? Like, what is it as a thing, and what would you envision it doing?
Okay, so a little background.
Yes.
I wrote a bill, guys. I wrote a whole bill to create a new executive level agency. It's a big one. And it arose because I did a thought experiment one day where I said, okay, what kind of resources would we need to bring to actually address this issue? Not in a, like, let's hire Deloitte people, or let's use prison labor. Like, what would we actually need to do? Like, if we are going to battle, how many tanks, how many troops, what do we actually need? And so in talking to a lot of really smarter people than myself and sitting down one day, I said, okay, what will this look like? And so that bill is what that would look like. It is 30 field offices across the United States directly employing oil and gas workers, directly employing out-of-work petroleum engineers and geologists and air quality experts, directly owning and operating our own rigs, our own, you know, electric fleet, apparently, of cars, and all the equipment that would be necessary to identify, detect leaks, monitor and repair, plug and abandon, and do all that is necessary. And, you know, it's over the last year in thinking this through and talking to people, this concept has really expanded beyond, you know, what I initially envisioned, which was, you know, trying to put these people back to work before their skills were lost, but also seeing this as the opportunity to put people to work that would not otherwise have work right now. And so, like, we talked about, like, how there's a whole alphabet soup of different agencies, state, federal, and local, who oversee oil and gas. And so we're talking, like, just dozens of spreadsheets with, like, you know, thousands of lines of well data, and you're trying to reconcile them into, like, one singular task. Well, wouldn't it be great if we had a federal jobs guarantee and someone could sign up for that from home, you know, 10 hours a week, 15 hours a week, in addition to their Medicare for All, in addition to their, you know, SNAP for All, in addition to all of the things, you know, they could have this thing where we can plug and play. And, you know, the thing about federal government is that we do have those kind of discrete projects all of the time. But typically we hire, like, a private contractor, you know, like in my own building in New Orleans, we would have, you know, like, a private IT contractor doing these discrete tasks. Like, we're moving, you know, all this data from one system to another. And, you know, while the people are getting paid pretty garbagey, the company itself is getting a sweet little profit. And that, you know, that loss is, you know, paid directly by us. And so instead of doing that, you know, giving someone fat and, you know, it's very inefficient, all these things, why don't we do that? And so then there's that. And now there's the launch of the Civilian Conservation Corps. We literally need people walking fields in Ohio and Pennsylvania, walking in, you know, California with metal detectors, with drones, with, like, you know, gas detectors. And we could be putting people to work doing this. So, like, I envision this as, like, you know, like the New Deal, but, like, really New Deal. And it's something that we need now, because if you look at methane emissions in the last 5-10 years, I mean, it has exploded since there was this thing called the crude oil export ban, where the United States could not export crude oil. And a lot of ghoulish people rallied to have this overturned during the Obama administration, and they were successful. And what this did was make previously unprofitable shale suddenly seem like a good investment. So private equity, you know, all the usual billionaire bros just poured money into shale. And as a consequence, I mean, the amount of production in the United States, we surpassed Russia in terms of production. And because shale is, like, you know, just the Wild West, and they're not regulated and no one's paying attention, I mean, just record amount of methane. So we are starting way behind You know, if we want to get to where we need to be, we need to assemble and amass all the forces necessary, because, you know, we need to rediscover what government should and what it should look like and what it should be. And I'm going to take a break for a second before I revisit that so you can well, go on my rant.
No, no, this is good. I mean, one thing that I think your article really drove home for me is, if I had been kind of presented this in a less comprehensive way, I think I might have thought about your proposed solution as what Pete Davis would call a nice to have, where it's like, you know, something that would be great if we can get it done. But I think what you have managed to really do, for me at least, is really drive home the fact that no, this is necessary. Like, we kind of have to do this. This is a problem that will result in deaths and continue resulting in deaths, both on the micro and macro scale. The people who are best equipped to deal with it are not going to be around forever, and we're not really replacing them. That, like, this is a kind of extreme problem and ready made for this kind of solution. And the other thing that you kind of touched on, which I think is really interesting, is we're talking about dealing with stuff in the real world. It's not like just a bureaucracy in the sense that everything can be done from behind a desk. You've got a bunch of data entry and analysis work to do. You've also got a bunch of just walking around out in fields and looking for stuff work to do. And then you've got like some really heavy engineering expertise involved work to do when you actually get down to like plugging the wells, right? It's both like a terrifying and like a juicy problem, I feel like. I guess I was really impressed with your kind of like the degree of thought that you've put into your draft bill and this sort of solution, because I think like the failing that we've encountered so far has been these kind of like, well, halfway, you know, we'll leave it up to the industry, we'll leave it up to the states, we'll do, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, and we'll compromise and we'll kind of eat away at it. And really, this problem seems to be something that like really calls for a comprehensive solution. And then I think the other thing that I had to kind of get through my head that like maybe listeners are stuck in this too, is you kind of get the sense it's like, well, oh, a whole new government agency, like that's crazy. But of course, it's not crazy at all, right? Like, we've done it a bunch of times recently, not only with like cabinet level, like Department of Homeland Security didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago, but also, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau didn't exist before 2010. It's not a crazy thing to do, especially when faced with this sort of problem.
Well, I want to break apart a few of those questions.
Yeah, please.
I would first say that most problems that we face are deserving of the appropriate resources to solve them. And this is one of many. I'm going to recircle to that part. With the point you just made about like creating nothing, like something from nothing, like, you know, let's flip it and say, like, if I came to you and said, okay, imagine a place where there's just millions of holes in the ground poisoning people, like, what is more reasonable and more adult and more like, how is that acceptable? Mm-hmm. Like, how is that like the adult view, like the status quo of patchwork? And this like goes back to like, okay, creating something from nothing. I would argue that a lot of governance in the United States over the last 20, 30, 40 years has been very piecemeal and been about how little can we get away with. And that is somehow like the adult position to take. You know, it's like the conservative view is like, okay, we're just going to like hollow it out as much as we can. And, you know, the more neoliberal view is like, we are going to, you know, establish thresholds for which problems we are going to solve. And that somehow makes us very adulty. And, you know, I would argue that neither is actual effective governing, and that, you know, government is merely a vessel for our priorities. And it's like this moral thing. And I'm always going to bring my mom game to the conversation, but it's like, you know, when you leave the house with a baby, as you will often do, you need to make sure you have the shit with you. You know, it doesn't just magically happen. You need to make sure you have everything and all the contingencies. You know, it's a terrible example, but it's like you're planning the kid's birthday party. I know it's not glamorous, but you have to get down to the level of how many napkins you need. And honestly, that is where we're at with government. And like, you see, like, when you don't think about that level of detail, what happens? Like, how many ICU beds do we have? How, like, means testing vaccine distribution, you know, telling people to open schools without having like ready-made testing scenarios, and like telling parents you have to do all of this without also having $2,000 survival checks, universal SNAP, and like a reduction in work hours. Like, you see what happens when you don't think out these details and just expect them to magically work out. you know, and I think there's a lot of wishful thinking amongst like the top people, because everyone wants to think like, I'm a top level, high level decision maker. I see the big picture. But while you're looking at the big picture, you're missing all the necessary details. And so for me, like, yeah, this is a unique problem that requires a unique solution. But it's also like, if I really want to have a real solution, what are the resources I need to bring to bear? Who are the people? And yeah. So yeah. It's the era of responsible government, folks. And that's what's unique about this moment in history, is like, we're all hearkening back to the New Deal. And, you know, while they did pursue a lot of worthwhile projects, a lot of it was make work, right? Like, how can we get people employed? How can we put money in their pockets so that, like, you know, people can eat and we can survive? The United States, as you know, Mr. Infrastructure, does not lack for things to do. You know, there's not a single like piece of American infrastructure, be it dams, you know, water infrastructure, our inland waterways, which I can go on a rant about, you know, rates above like a C for the American Society of Civil Engineers. I mean, we have work to do. You know, it's like the fact that we don't have every single person employed in the United States is a cynical policy choice. It is not a realistic choice. We have work to do.
Including going and finding I mean, this is the thing that just keeps coming up again and again. And I feel like every time we talk about this kind of stuff, like going back to, I guess like years ago now, probably when we interviewed the guy from Strong Towns, Chuck Marone, I want to say, who's like, one of his points was basically that it's very sexy to build new stuff and it's very not sexy to maintain old stuff. And I think back to just like some of the quotes that I remember pulling from people in terms of like aquifer management, where they're like, oh, you know, we realize that this resource is going to last 25 or 30 years at the rate we're pulling it, but we'll figure out something else by then. There's one way of kind of looking and thinking about that, which is like, you know, that's so frustrating. But then especially with the oil and gas wells, it really is a strategic choice by some profit motivated actors to get us into this frame of mind.
It's classic Dime and Dash. I mean, it's a fraud.
It's extractive. It's extractive capitalism, right?
Well, it's a fraud. It's like complete, like, and you know, this is the thing, and we haven't talked about the financial side of this at all, but you know, the way that people refer to these decommissioning obligations are, it's asset retirement obligations. And, you know, I know. And from, you know, a lot of governments like New Mexico, for instance, are very dependent on the resource rents from these lease sales, right? But they're only looking at one side of the ledger. You know, they're looking at the immediate gains right now, like I'm getting, you know, dollars to fund my schools, and they don't see in the future those asset retirement obligations are going to bleed them dry. You know, in Texas, they have the Texas Permanent School Fund, which is funded by oil and gas. It's the Texas Railroad Commission. And, you know, I think it's important for people to recognize that that's an institution that will be bankrupted, you know, not so far in the future because of those asset retirement obligations. And we're only looking at one side of the ledger. And, you know, my dad, he is very, he knows all the scams. He knows all like the, like he loves to tell me like different types of scams and like, this is how this guy does it. And I always think of the grocery store scam, where someone moves into the town and they, you know, they buy everything on credit from all the local producers, you know, and they're like, great, I will pay you back as soon as the grocery store is open. And then they leave and, you know, they take all the shit with them. And like, this is kind of this, like they took all the shit with them. This is just a classic grocery store scam. Like these guys are debtors. And, you know, part of what the Abandoned Well Administration will do is create a new regime for, you know, assessing, you know, the solvency of these companies and the solvency of fields and the solvencies of wells, and even the solvency of like leasing programs, because you should be able to know based on production field data, because a lot of these regulatory agencies, you know, collect production data, like how much are they pulling from that well? And from that data, and that's how they determine, you know, the taxes and the resource rents and all of that. And using that information, we can chart a production curve and have a pretty good idea at what point they will reach the point, like where it will no longer be economically like solvent. Like it's no longer worth it for them to have people out there and equipment out there. And so we can know like at what point they are a debtor to the United States government. At what point are they insolvent? At what point are they stealing from you and I? And at that point, the AWA, you know, like summarizing all the fields for a company, will come in and take over these companies and operate them to fund the decommissioning. Because honestly, the best analog, and this is something that I've talked to a few people about, is, you know, the savings and loans crisis of the 1990s, where these companies were basically committing control fraud. They were like robbing the piggy bank for themselves. And that's what these companies are doing. And during that time, the United States government went in and took over these savings and loans operations. We have precedent. We have, like, you know, a whole financial mechanism to go in and take over these companies because they are officially debtors to the United States. And so, I mean, that's the other side of it. You know, it's not only this, you know, they're not only abandoning workers, they're not only abandoning, you know, a physical infrastructure that's poisoning communities, but they're also abandoning their financial obligations to these things. And so, yeah, the Abandoned Well Administration looks at all these things in, as one entity, yeah, as one problem to tackle.
How can we get this done?
Okay, guys. So I've been one woman on a campaign, one person, and I have allies, and no groups have officially endorsed or signed on, but they're hip to it. They're like, I like this idea. This sounds cool. Especially after the EO that came out, like all the EOs that were coming out and the suspension on oil and gas leasing. Because we don't want people to be out of work, more people to be out of work. We want to put people to work. What are we going to do? You know, call me, slide into those DMs. True Transition is about organizing people to kind of make this happen. I'm just one person. It is sitting on the desk of some very cool, prominent people on the Hill. And they have some really cool staff people that I've spoken to who are really on board. But we all know that it doesn't just take a good idea to get something passed. It doesn't. You can't just have like a good moral position. Otherwise, we'd have Medicare for all. Otherwise, we'd have all these things. We need to build like a broad base of support and pressure. And, you know, I personally think that we could build bipartisan support. Because if you have a bunch of people in Louisiana saying, you know, put me to work, I've got skills, I can clean up my community, I can clean up the marshes, you know, then you can put pressure on Cassidy and Kennedy. You can put pressure on Garrett Graves. And you can put pressure across the United States on all these people. So that's what I'm trying to do. And organize people around that. Unless, you know, hey, President Biden, you listening? I know you're a big current affairs subscriber. You know, we'll share a root beer and we'll talk about this. And we'll talk about our favorite Westerns. And then we'll talk about how we need to clean up these spaces because it's not going to be good for your grandkids, not going to be good for my kids. And we could put some real cool people back to work.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're talking about is this is again, I think like this is horrifying, but also my favorite kind of published thing that you've written, which is something that's like, here's a giant national scale problem that you haven't thought about it. And here's a horrifying description of it. And now let me tell you what a potential solution would be and exactly how to get it done.
Ta-da!
There you go. Just ready made. So what's the website for True Transition?
I mean, it's a landing space, guys. So please, don't keep your hopes up. TrueTransition.org.
Okay. And where can people find you?
I am on Twitter, Bayou Terrier. If you want like 100% more oil and gas stuff, some dredge boats thrown in for good measure, there you go.
Yeah. And so I would encourage everybody to, if you haven't already, go read Megan's article, The Wreckage of the Last Energy Epoch, Abandoned Wells and Workers, which again gets into a lot more detail on all this stuff and also links to her bill and includes the excellent seal for the Abandoned Well Administration.
The logo, yeah.
The logo.
Seal. It's, just imagine that on like what are those things called? Those jumpsuit onesie things?
Oh, hell yeah. I don't know, yeah, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And guys, I promise you today, I've already agreed that I'm going to get that tattoo if we can pass this.
Yeah.
I will. That's what I want to do.
Okay. Abandoned Well Administration, Megan Milk and Bibbin, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much.
All right. See y'all later.